How many last best chances does the planet get? On the eve of the big climate summit in Glasgow, the UN Secretary General gets real.
We are still on track for climate catastrophe, even with the last announcements that were made.
We look at what it will take to get on track. Also ahead, Myanmar's military has been in power for 8 months. A new investigation reveals things are worse than imagined.
We have identified that there is a systematic, widespread use of torture against detainees within Myanmar right now.
What reporters discovered inside the prisons there. I'm Marco Werman, and India nods to Halloween with local ghost stories.
Indian ghosts tend to be, you know, you can touch them, they can pick things up. They like to work, which is a strange thing.
Yes, that is a strange thing. All ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you can make it here this Friday. We begin today with something that impacts everyone on Earth. This weekend, world leaders are heading to Glasgow for what's been billed as the last best hope for averting the worst impacts of climate change. The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, has been reporting on the long road to Glasgow. So set the scene for us, Carolyn. What is this UN conference actually going to look like?
So when I get there next week, I'm expecting about 20 to 25,000 people in a big conference center in Glasgow. World leaders early next week will make some speeches to set the tone, and then they'll leave so that negotiators can really get down to the nitty-gritties. There's also a public space that's kind of like a green convention center, and activists are always very visible on the streets in the host city of these summits.
It's called COP26. Remind us what COP and 26 stand for.
Oh, yeah. It's the 26th Conference of the Parties. That's parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change.
So 26 of these have happened. We keep hearing this one in Glasgow is the last best hope. Why is that?
It's being framed as the key moment for meeting a goal that the most vulnerable countries say is key to their very survival.
The overarching ambition that we have got.
This is COP President Alok Sharma.
Is that we want to be able to say with credibility coming out of Glasgow that we have kept 1.5 within reach, 1.5 alive.
So the backstory here, in Paris back in 2015, world leaders signed on to limiting global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius and pursue efforts to keep the rise below 1.5 degrees. But the promises that countries made about how much they'd cut their carbon emissions did not add up to anything close to that. This year is the year that they were asked to come back and submit new pledges for the year 2030. And that is where this last best chance language comes from, because that's the year that scientists say we need to nearly halve emissions, cut them in half, to keep warming to that 1.5 degree target.
So Glasgow, Carolyn, is the last best hope to fix things, and yet the planet is still not on track for that 1.5 degree goal, right?
That's right. 1.5 has always been a wildly ambitious target. Even when it was set in Paris back in 2015, it would have required a wholesale change in the global economy. Today, even with all of the updated pledges that have been submitted already,
less than 1 week before COP26 in Glasgow, we are still on track for climate catastrophe.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. According to a UN estimate released this week, we're on track for about 2.7 degrees of warming.
Wow.
So what is likely to happen at the COP is that countries are going to agree to come back again and reassess their commitments ahead of schedule in a couple of years instead of the five that are spelled out in the agreement. And that's what they're probably going to say is keeping the goal of 1.5 alive.
So kind of kicking the can down the road again and hoping for hope that there won't be catastrophe. What else is on the agenda for COP in Glasgow?
So two other big things. The first is money for developing countries to transition to renewable energy and deal with the impacts of climate change. Richer countries have not delivered on money they've promised so far, which Colombian climate policy expert Maria Laura Bojas Viejo says is souring things even before the summit kicks off.
The COP will be coming into a sense of distrust and tension, which has been building for several years already.
Developing countries will be asking for a detailed plan on how they're going to get $100 billion that's been promised to them. They're going to ask for an emphasis on grants instead of loans and more money for adaptation.
And delegates, I gather, have to get their heads around this thing called the Paris Rulebook. What is that?
Right. It's the final rules on things like how countries are going to report their carbon emission cuts and carbon markets. So you can think of this as finally ending the negotiation phase of this UN process that's been going on since Paris and finally getting to that implementation phase.
So let's turn to Washington real quick. Lawmakers have been in a feverish push to get some climate legislation on the books so President Biden has more credibility when he gets to Glasgow. We spoke about that on the show a couple of days ago. How's that looking?
Yesterday, the White House published its updated Build Back Better plan, which includes $55 billion earmarked for climate programs. But there's no vote scheduled, so the U.S. is not going to have new legislation in hand to say, hey, this is how we're going to meet the targets that we've set out. So that is going to hurt U.S. credibility.
And one of the other big players on the stage is China, of course. Where do they stand going into the summit?
So also just yesterday, China finally submitted its updated pledge for how much it will cut carbon emissions by 2030, and it didn't significantly increase its promises. A Greenpeace China policy expert tweeted yesterday that this casts a shadow on the global climate effort. So this climate summit is not likely to be a major turning point like a lot of people were hoping for, but forward progress is still possible.
The World's Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
We've got more details on what to expect from the climate summit in Glasgow on our website, theworld.org. President Biden made a lot of specific campaign promises about how he was going to amend the immigration system. That included stopping private companies from running immigration detention facilities. Biden has not yet delivered on that. But as the World's Daisy Contreras reports, there's news this week from the state of Washington that has encouraged some immigrant rights groups.
Carlos Amaya lists the jobs he did every day. I cleaned the tables and wiped the phones, Amaya says. But we didn't get protective equipment while using harsh chemicals. Sometimes we'd have skin reactions to the chemicals, he says. Amaya, who's from El Salvador, spent 2 years at the Northwest Ice Processing Center in Tacoma, Washington, south of Seattle. It's a privately run immigration detention facility managed by the GEO Group. They paid Amaya just $1 a day for the work he did there. But that could soon change. Washington State's attorney general sued the GEO Group over those wages. This week, a federal jury said the company owes current and former migrant detainees the state's minimum wage, about $13 an hour. It's only right, says Manuel Abrego, another former detainee.
Y nosotros somos los que mantenemos ese lugar en pie.
We're the ones that keep those facilities running, he says. Abrego was released from the Tacoma Detention Center 3 years ago and now works as an immigrant community organizer.
Y es como esclavitud moderna, ¿verdad? Porque nos están usando para mantener los lugares.
Without the right pay, he calls it modern slavery. They're using us, he says. It's how private detention companies make a profit from housing migrant detainees, says Silky Shaw. She's with the Detention Watch Network, a national group that wants to end immigrant detention.
And often it's coerced because they get a dollar a day and they use that money to get services in the commissary or use it for phone calls or other things that they might need.
The GEO Group didn't respond to an interview request, but they're expected to appeal the jury's decision. If they lose that, this could be a significant win, says Shaw, because Washington State is also set to ban for-profit detention centers by 2025. The judge still has to say how much money could be owed, says Maru Mora Villalpando. She's with La Resistencia, or The Resistance, an immigrant rights group in Tacoma that's been watching the lawsuit closely.
We are starting to write letters that we're going to send to everyone that we're in touch with at the detention center, letting them know of their victory and letting them know that, you know, they're supposed to now be paying minimum wage.
She's also compiling a list of people who spend time at the detention center but who were deported, letting them know that they might qualify for back pay. Meanwhile, Carlos Amaya, who just left detention and just found out about the jury's decision, is now living with his family on the East Coast. He's working on getting his GED now, he says. He's also thinking about what he might do if he receives pay for the hours he spent cleaning up the detention center he was once held in.
Yo no necesito mucho el dinero. Pero ese dinero me puede ayudar para yo conseguirme un abogado para pagarlo para migración.
He says he doesn't really need the money, but maybe he'll hire a lawyer to help him with his immigration case.
Ese dinero me puede ayudar para donarlo a la gente que está presa en las detenciones.
Then he pauses and says maybe he'll donate it to migrants still at the detention center in Tacoma to help them with what they might need.
Porque yo estuve ahí, yo sé cómo me siento, ¿me entiendes?
Because I was there, he says. I know what it's like. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
The U.S. and dozens of other countries are ramping up coronavirus boosters. Here's a chief scientist at the WHO, Soumya Swaminathan, commenting this week on the situation.
Today, the number of boosters that's being administered around the world is three times the amount of vaccines being administered in low-income countries. So the issue is prioritization of those parts of the world that don't have adequate vaccines.
The vaccine gap between high and low-income countries is wide. The World's Ilana Gordon has been reporting on that disparity, and this week there were lots of developments on that front. First of all, Ilana, we've been hearing since basically the start of the pandemic about potential inequities, and they actually emerged in a big way across the globe. Many say it's a moral failure of the pandemic, but has there been any progress in turning things around?
Well, just to set the stage, a lot of jabs have gone into the arms of people around the world, nearly 7 billion doses. And that means that nearly 40% of the world is fully vaccinated. But like you were saying, the inequities are wide. If you look at places like in Africa, most countries on the continent have yet to vaccinate even 10% of their population. And that's a supply issue mainly. It's not because people don't want the vaccine. There's this G20 summit this weekend, and global health leaders are calling on countries to commit billions of dollars more in investments to urgently help address this.
So what went wrong? Wasn't the COVAX initiative supposed to get vaccines to low-income countries?
It was, but it's faced a lot of problems. The vaccine companies, they haven't been filling the orders for vaccines from COVAX as quickly as orders from wealthier countries who can pay more. You asked about progress, though. Distribution has been slow with COVAX, but it is starting to pick up a little bit.
So I know that there have been other efforts to increase access. This week, BioNTech announced it would be developing a new mRNA manufacturing facilities in Rwanda and Senegal. Earlier this month, Moderna announced similar plans in Africa. How much is that going to help?
Well, the short answer is not much in the immediate future. These manufacturing facilities could take months to set up. BioNTech said the facility could go up sometime in the middle of next year. I spoke with Fatima Hassan about this. She directs the South African advocacy group, the Health Justice Initiative.
I think all of these announcements have one thing in common. They are a little bit too late. And in addition, they still exercise exclusive control over all the relevant aspects of a particular arrangement or deal. They make all the decisions.
And they, Marco, as in companies, they're in the driver's seat. They're not sharing production knowledge with others, which is what Hassan and others have been pushing for. In the case of BioNTech also, they're planning to produce about 50 million doses next year on the continent of over a billion people.
So too late and too little. So back to the immediate needs. What about donations of vaccines?
Countries have made big promises. Over a billion doses actually have been committed, but only a small percentage have actually come through. I asked Gian Gandhi about this. He's with UNICEF. And he says so many details are unclear about when these vaccines are arriving.
Which vaccine we're talking about, how many doses each month, and when those will materialize.
And Gandhi says clarity is really essential for planning. In some cases, doses are nearing their expiration when they arrive, and that means they may wind up not getting used because UNICEF and others just can't get them into people's arms fast enough. And then there's this other thing, which is be careful what you wish for. Gandhi expects donations to pick up, and then that creates this new problem and concern, which is a bottleneck that's starting to build up. You need syringes to be able to use these vaccines. There's a special type that you need. And if the world actually starts to actually get on track with these donations and contracts, UNICEF predicts they'll actually have a shortage of up to 2.2 billion syringes next year.
Wow. The World's Ilana Gordon covers global health for the show. Thank you very much, Ilana.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Sudan has a new strongman, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, seized control of Sudan's government early this week. But the pressure and protests against military rule in the country are growing. Also condemning the military coup in Sudan, the Biden White House, the United Nations, and the African Union. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi has the latest.
The takeover by Sudan's military has been met with defiance across the country. Doctors have gone on strike nationwide, as have pharmacists, bankers, and many others. They view General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan's decision to dissolve the government as an attempt to seize power from the people and derail Sudan's transition to democracy. On Thursday, General Burhan said he would create a new joint government with civilian leaders and that perhaps even Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok could be the one to lead it. Hamdok is the man ousted by Sudan's military earlier this week. Burhan said the military and civilian leaders in Sudan are partners. They've been sharing power since 2019, when dictator Omar al-Bashir was ousted from power. Cameron Hudson is a former U.S. State Department official. He's with the Atlantic Council's Africa Center.
We have to remember that just 4 days ago, he was essentially under house arrest, the prime minister, and now we're talking about having him restored as prime minister. So that's clearly an indication that there is some backtracking going on.
International pressure has been mounting in recent days. On Thursday, the United Nations Security Council called on the military to restore Sudan's joint military-civilian transitional government.
The natural inclination from the international community is to cut a deal, to find a way out of this, to relieve the pressure that's been growing, and to, you know, cut some political deal that would preserve some of the military's interests, give the civilians what they want.
Hudson says military leaders like General Burhan are worried about being held to account for past crimes and about losing their grip on parts of the economy they have long controlled. But now the question is this: will the Sudanese people accept a partnership with the same military rulers who went back on their promise to share power? Samahar al-Mubarak is a pharmacist in Khartoum. She's also a spokeswoman for the Sudanese Professionals Association. It's been organizing nationwide strikes and protests all week. Al-Mubarak says she doesn't trust the military.
2 years on, they're still attempting to seize power. This shows that any form of partnership is just absurd.
At 30 years old, al-Mubarak has spent her whole life under military dictatorship.
Even if there are pressures to go back to the partnership, everybody should know that this is a time bomb that's going to explode any moment.
This week, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, said it's not realistic to sideline the military entirely. That's because they've long been integral players in Sudan's political system, says Cameron Hudson of the Atlantic Council.
The military, since Sudan's independence in 1956, except for a few very brief periods, has essentially run this country.
This could be the turning point. Mass demonstrations are planned tomorrow across Sudan, despite the fact that the internet is down. Samahar al-Mubarak, the activist, says people are distributing leaflets, using graffiti on the walls of Khartoum to get the word out. They're also setting up barricades to block military vehicles.
We have trucks, armed vehicles coming at us that are trying to attack the protesters and to kill them.
Several demonstrators have reportedly been killed by the armed forces so far this week. But al-Mubarak says that is not going to stop protesters.
We are aware if we do not fix our country, if we do not set the way we want our future to be, nobody else will do it for us.
For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Israel said this week that it's going ahead with plans to build 3,000 new homes for Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank, and the Biden administration is not happy about it. The White House is scolding Israel's move, saying it damages the prospects for a two-state solution. But beyond rebukes and shaking its diplomatic head, what else is the Biden administration willing to do? To talk this through, we turn to Khaled El-Gindi, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. Khaled, how do you read the Biden administration's response to Israel's building more homes for settlers in the West Bank?
Well, I mean, this isn't the first settlement announcement that we've seen during the Biden administration, but it's clear that the administration has taken a stronger tone this time around. The official position was that they were not going to publicly criticize Israel, whether for settlements or for other things. So this clearly seems to have rubbed the administration the wrong way, and they're sort of dispensing with that private criticism that they were limited to before and are now openly critical.
So for you, why do you think the rhetoric at the White House went up with this announcement?
I think particularly because we've seen not just settlement announcements, but there's a great deal of tension going on in the region. You have these evictions that are pending in East Jerusalem. You have, obviously, the situation in Gaza is very fragile, There's violence carried out by settlers on Palestinians on an almost daily basis. And so I think they're sort of fed up.
So if we're counting on what's going on privately behind the scenes, what kind of leverage does President Biden have with the relatively new prime minister, Naftali Bennett?
A lot of leverage. The United States provides $3.8 billion of military assistance to Israel every year. On top of that, they've just approved another billion for Iron Dome funding.
That's the defense technology that Israel uses to ward off missiles from Gaza.
Right. It's a missile defense system developed and paid for by the United States. So there are many points of leverage. It's really a question of whether there's political will. And this administration has really no appetite for applying any meaningful pressure on Israel or using its leverage, in part because of the fragility of the ruling coalition in Israel, in part because of American domestic politics, divisions within the Democratic Party, also because it's just not a major priority.
So if the Biden administration is not going to make a negotiated settlement between Israel and the Palestinians a priority, what else could the White House do to reduce tensions between Israelis and Palestinians?
Well, I think they need to look at the causes of those tensions, which are the pending evictions in Jerusalem, the ongoing blockade in Gaza, the settler violence happening almost daily against Palestinians in the West Bank. And also the fact that you have a weakening Palestinian authority. I mean, there needs to be a plan to address these realities on the ground. And all of the trend lines are negative. And so you have to kind of staunch the hemorrhage. And that means allocating some resources. In addition to a confirmed ambassador in Israel, you need a team of people who are going to work on this in the administration. But one thing that it could do is sort of draw a line in the sand and say, you know, this administration likes to talk about centering human rights as a pillar of its foreign policy. And they've also talked about that Palestinians and Israelis should enjoy equal measures of freedom, security, prosperity, and so forth. Those are strong statements. And there is nothing in the Biden administration's actions that in any way relate to those statements. And so, you know, having a proper team in place that could sort of connect the rhetoric to the actual reality on the ground, I think is a good place to start.
Khaled El-Gindi is director of the program on Palestine and Palestinian-Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back with more. You're listening to The World. This year's hot Halloween costumes, Ted Lasso, characters from Squid Game, and of course, vampires. Stick around and you'll find out where they came from.
Whenever you would have an illness that would come, especially something that would reach pandemic proportions, you would need to have a way of explaining what was causing it. So the vampire was what filled that void in science centuries ago.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It has been 8 months since the military seized control in Myanmar. During that time, the military leaders detained thousands of people. Now a new investigation from the Associated Press has found evidence of systematic torture of detainees. Victoria Milko is one of the AP reporters who worked on the investigation and joins us from Jakarta, Indonesia. So your reporting unearthed some pretty horrific details. Can you start by giving us the headline? I mean, notably, that you believe there's a system of torture across Myanmar that the military has engineered.
That's correct. So we have identified that there is a systematic, widespread use of torture against detainees within Myanmar right now. That includes people from all religions, children, women, men, civilians who are doing nothing more than riding their bike down the street when they're arrested and taken off the street. It's been quite clear to us that this is not an isolated incident.
So that's a really wide range of people being targeted. Your reporting suggests it seems random at times?
From what we saw and heard from people that we spoke to, it does seem random at times. There were moments where there'd be a group of young men sitting at a tea shop in a metropolitan city, just enjoying their evening when they were snatched by security forces and shoved into a van, began to get beaten by security forces. There were other times that it seemed quite targeted, like activists that were being sought after. People were getting taken out of their homes. Sometimes, more frequently during the protests that have been going on, people will be snatched off the street and put into vans and then sent to interrogation centers across the country.
and then detained in really subhuman conditions, sometimes for months.
That's right. So of the 28 people we spoke to, a majority of them were actually experiencing their abuses in interrogation centers. They're a bit removed from the prisons that a lot of people have seen over the years through Myanmar's political history with political prisoners. These are completely fenced off, controlled by the military, shadowy conditions, no access for the outside world. And people are put into solitary confinement, dark rooms, not given food, forced to defecate in plastic bags, seeing pools of blood in the corner of the rooms that they're held in, and just every few hours taken out for atrocious situational beatings.
Do we know how many people have died in the system?
There's a few different statistics, but the one that we go with and the most reliable, which many believe to be an undercount, is from an organization called the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners that operates in the country. And I think that we've seen over 1,200 civilians killed at this point. And again, that's thought to be an undercount, as those are only the confirmed cases.
What's been the response from the military in Myanmar to the AP investigation?
We were able to email the military. We received a one-line response from them that they didn't have any interest in answering our nonsense questions. We haven't received any further detail from them, though we have reached out for comment via the phone and email.
So military rule in Myanmar began with that coup back in February. You also spoke with former military captains, military personnel who did not follow the new coup leaders. What did those former military personnel tell you?
That's right. We were able to locate three people who had recently defected from the military since February 1st. Two of the people we spoke with described just rampant torture throughout the system. One captain who was hiding in the jungle, who was able to speak to us via Zoom, was talking about how he witnessed two civilians that were tortured to death while in military custody. And in an effort to hide the fact that those two had died in military custody, they were taken to a hospital. Glucose IV drips were attached to their dead bodies, and the doctor was forced to say that they didn't indeed die from abuse, but they had died from their own causes. So that kind of testimony from people in the military system itself, which is a rare but increasingly common kind of thing we're seeing out of Myanmar, just provided such a strong backbone to our investigation that we hadn't seen anywhere else.
So this was a really thorough investigation on torture in Myanmar, but you're based in Indonesia, Victoria. How were you and AP able to confirm the details?
That's correct. I'm based in Jakarta, and Kristen Gelino, my reporter on this, is based in Sydney. But both of us have been reporting in the region for quite some time, and I was living in Myanmar from late 2016 until the end of 2019. So we've been following the situation quite closely since February 1st when the military took over the government, and have been doing some other reporting. And throughout our reporting, we just kept seeing these horrific photos of broken faces, distorted bodies, blurry bullet wounds, and the word torture hashtagged on the internet, sources sending us information about someone that had gone missing and apparently was tortured. And even the Myanmar state media at one point put out these photos of people who had been detained and their faces were just bruised and bloodied and almost unidentifiable. So after a few instances of seeing that, I think we both looked at each other and said, hey, again, this doesn't seem like something happening one time. This seems like something that we have a moral obligation to look into. And the more we looked into it, the more we uncovered.
Why is Myanmar's military setting up these detainee centers and torturing, and in some cases, killing people for information?
We think the message is quite clear from the military to civilians, activists, anyone who's thinking about opposing their rule, is don't do it. And whatever it takes, we will make sure that you don't do it. We've heard reports from people that if they were arrested, their friends were also arrested with them. If they were fleeing from being arrested, their family members would be arrested in lieu of them. It just seems that the military at this point is willing to use whatever form of abuse and control it can over its own civilians to maintain its grip.
So, Victoria, the U.S. State Department has taken notice of the AP report and is demanding further investigation. I just want to recall that just last week there was some hope that things might be shifting a bit in Myanmar with the release of some 2,500 detainees, but now this investigation seems to put that hope in check. What signals are coming from Myanmar that what you revealed is continuing or maybe slowing down?
Since our report came out, which was a little more than 24 hours ago, we've already had an immense outpouring of response from people in Myanmar saying that they've had similar abuses themselves, their friends have experienced abuse at the hands of the military. On the international community level, we've had people from the State Department express, as you said, outrage at what's happening, demanding a deeper investigation. And human rights organizations around the world have reached out condemning the Myanmar military's actions and abuse against the civilians as well. But I think it's yet to be seen what the U.S. government, the United Kingdom, the EU are going to do for further response to these atrocities.
Victoria Milko is a reporter with the Associated Press based in Jakarta. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
China wants to be seen as a global leader on combating climate change, but it's also the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases. Pushing the Chinese government to address that contradiction is what's on this week's Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Today, we've got the first in a three-part series about how environmental issues resonate in China. From Shanghai, here's the world's Rebecca Canther.
Taking part in any sort of public protest here in China comes with big risks. That doesn't mean people just stay quiet, though, when it comes to things they feel strongly about. This is from an online video shot last year in southern China. It shows a girl with choppy bangs lying on a stone bench in a park next to a lake. Nearby, retirees are doing their evening exercise routine. The girl, who's by herself, has a few protest signs. One in English says, "Student Climate Strike." In Chinese, it says, "There's no vaccine for the climate crisis."
This spirit of nature, it is embedded in my blood and bones.
Oi O is a climate change activist from the city of Guilin. She's only 18, but she's been involved with environmental issues going back to the start of high school.
I read a small booklet by the Chinese Vegan Association about how veganism, how it will be a part of the solution to the global warming.
Oh, says she decided to go vegan, and she told her family they should too.
They think probably there is something wrong with me. They just really confused and trying to persuade me to have some meat.
Oh, says she didn't stop there. She promoted the use of biodegradable plastic bags at school and basically took every opportunity she could to talk about environmentalism. She says it didn't take long to learn this was going to be a lonely path.
I feel like, although I didn't find anyone who do the same as me, but I just continuing doing it.
Oh says she set new goals for herself, to go to Harvard and become a voice for a healthy planet, like Al Gore. Then in 2019, she got an email about the first global climate strike and how students around the world were coming together to work on climate change.
They all came together in this day, really sacrificed themselves to make a change. And this really inspired me.
Oh says she was inspired to join a Chinese climate activist group, but she couldn't find one. Then she saw Greta Thunberg on television and how she walked out of school to protest at government offices.
I feel I have this responsibility too because I'm part of this country, of the nation. But it's just unimaginable that what it will happen when I stand in front of the government to do this strike.
Oh tells me she was scared about the idea of taking a stand. Her parents were freaked out about it too. They consulted relatives and even had her talk with someone who had been to jail to explain the risks. In the end, though, Oh says her dad decided to support her protest. She went to a crowded area in the city center and displayed her signs for a few hours every day for a week. Then the police came, detained her and her parents for several hours, and they asked her to promise not to protest ever again. Since that first visit to the police station, Oi O has traveled around China staging one-woman protests in several cities. On occasion, she's joined by another student, but mostly she goes out on her own. This is a video from one of O's protests, showing her on the street trying to engage people in conversation. Most don't understand what she's trying to do. They've never heard of Greta Thunberg or the student-led climate movement. Her methods seem very foreign to people in China.
And there is even older people who passing by. They said I should like learn more about Chinese traditional culture, not do this foreign stuff.
But foreign stuff, like street protests, is now O's real focus. Earlier this year, she decided to take time off from school, and she's traveling around Europe, meeting other climate activists. She says she plans to return to China. Youth activists in the West see OEO as sort of a Chinese Greta Thunberg. But inside China, she's got a lot of critics, says Yifei Li. He's the author of a book about China's official efforts to go green. And he says youth activists like OEO are rare because of the way the government educates young people.
A lot of the times, climate change is described as a purely scientific problem, as a problem that, you know, top scientists at places like the Chinese Academy of Sciences are working on and that they will have a solution for, that this isn't something that ordinary citizens ought to be worrying about.
Li says it's unsurprising that OEO's Western style of activism is not really catching on here.
It's a campaign style that the stability-obsessed government of China is very much trying to suppress. So she's, on the one hand, up against the cultural norms of what effective advocacy looks like, and on the other hand, she's up against a lot of government and pressure within China.
But OEO is definitely part of something bigger here in China. Kate Wang is a vegan environmentalist in the Chinese city of Kunming. Wang tells me she admires OEO. She's our pride because she's brave and willing to speak out, she says. For the world, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
All of you out there with little kids know what's happening on Sunday night. Even if you don't have kids, you still can't avoid Halloween. Across India, Halloween parties have become quite popular. Rituals like trick-or-treating, donning costumes, or carving pumpkins, not so much of that. But ghost stories? India's got plenty of those. From Kolkata, reporter Sandeep Roy tells us that you can learn a lot about a country's history by looking at its demons and monsters.
Rakesh Khanna found this out while researching what might be the first ever illustrated A to Z guide of the ghosts, monsters, and demons of India.
I think there's 322 entries, and there's some you know subcategories. So I think maybe somewhere around 700 totally.
From the Avi of South India, which is like the sigh that leaves the body at the moment of death to linger on as a ghost, to the Zun Hindor from Mizoram in northeastern India, which has the disgusting habit of drinking from puddles of other people's urine. Khanna, who grew up in California and now lives in Chennai in India, says Western ghosts, think Casper or Moaning Myrtle from Harry Potter, are different.
They tend to be kind of wispy, transparent things that float around in the dark, and they don't really interact with matter that much.
Indian ghosts are different.
Indian ghosts tend to be, you know, you can touch them, they can pick things up, they like to work.
The Deyam, for example, has a long tongue which can wiggle into the next room and do chores like turning off the gas burner. The ghosts of India reflect its diverse geography. Ghosts from the chilly mountains of Kashmir wear fur caps. Mecho Bhoots from Bengal, a land of rivers, love fish, while the islands of the Indian Ocean are the romping grounds of the Faru Fureta reef monster.
Faru Fureta, which smells like stinky old sponges and corals and eats people and has crystal daggers for teeth. They're cool.
Also, centuries of sea trade and migration meant Indian ghosts have found a perch in parts of Southeast Asia. The beautiful Mohini Pay smells of jasmine flowers, but sucks out the life of anyone she bewitches. She haunted Tamil Nadu in South India. Now she's crossed oceans.
You know, you have Mohini Pays now in Singapore and Tamil ghosts, which have appeared recently in the folklore of Malaysia and Singapore.
The ghost A to Z reflects disquieting social truths going way back. Branding women witches was a way to seize their property. Many ghosts are women.
Murdered women are often reincarnated as yakshas who go and take revenge on the people who did them wrong.
Waves of invaders and migrants have also brought their own ghosts and monsters to India. There are 2,000-year-old statues of yakshas, supernatural deities left over perhaps from some pre-Hindu animist faith. Then there are ultra-modern ghosts like Rose, model employee on the night shift at a call center near Delhi.
And then she never comes back, and when they look her up, they find out that the building was built on top of a cemetery where Rose was buried.
But while modernity might have given us a rose or two, in general, it's not good for ghosts, says Rakesh Khanna.
A lot of people say that electric lights have driven them away.
But with 700 ghosts and monsters at his disposal, his Halloween costume choices, at least, are a lot richer. But he says he'll probably keep it simple.
I might just go with being a Yeti. It's nice and simple. Get a big hairy costume and some stilts.
Except, according to Ghosts, Monsters, and Demons of India, there are about half a dozen kinds of Yetis, big and small, to choose from. For the world, this is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
The tremors started in mid-September, and by the end of that month, there were explosions every day. La Palma, one of Spain's Canary Islands off the coast of North Africa, has been experiencing its first volcanic eruptions in 50 years. The volcano has been exploding for more than a month. Roger Fry lives less than 2 miles away from Cumbre Vieja, the volcano he refers to as the Beast.
We are just under steady influence of this volcano, which is sometimes very loud, very explosive. So it's a steady up and down, and we really don't know where this is going to go.
Fry has been taking videos from his home almost every day. Lava spouting into the sky. Rocks the size of houses tumbling down the side of the volcano, and rivers of lava splashing behind them. The ash clouds never seem to stop billowing over nearby neighborhoods.
When the ash falls, it's a little bit like rain. It sounds like rain, but it is impossible to stay outside without a face covering and with glasses, because the ash is very, very small, and sometimes it goes into your eyes.
Fry says that for weeks, residents have been cleaning piles of ash from their houses and roofs.
It's a permanent task to clean ash. Ash is everywhere, so you have to be careful that you are not bringing everything into your house, because those tiny, tiny little ash pieces, they're not very good for your health.
But not all residents are so lucky to even have roofs to clean. David Calvo is with the Volcanological Institute of the Canary Islands. He says more than 2,000 structures have been destroyed by lava, as well as big banana plantations. But thanks to early detection, no one was killed.
The big success of this eruption is that nobody was hurt. We have no casualties at all. We have 8,000 displaced people, but with no casualties.
Calvo says they're watching the volcano closely and hoping the lava does not start moving towards more populated areas. They don't know when the eruptions will stop, but they do know rebuilding will take a long time.
I've seen with my own eyes houses buried up to the chimney with 4 or 5 meters of ash. That would be really difficult to recover and to take all that ash out of these locations.
That is once the eruptions finally come to an end. Finally today, from the Department of Spookiness, Halloween ghosts, goblins, and ghouls are meant to be scary, and then you've got vampires. Some are campy, like the Count, the beloved Sesame Street Muppet, or, on the opposite extreme, Andy Warhol's Dracula. Some are sexy, like Edward, the romantic, idealistic lover in the Twilight series. But all vampires emerge from a long, deep-rooted history in Eastern Europe, a history that parallels disease. Stanley Stepanek is an assistant professor of Slavic languages and literatures at the University of Virginia. He's been teaching a course on vampires for a decade. He joins us from Charlottesville. Stanley, where did the vampire myth come from?
One of the important details about the vampire in original Slavic belief is that it was primarily a symbol of death and disease. We're talking about a time period here, even going up into the 18th century when there was a significant case of vampire hysteria. People, just like all of our ancestors centuries ago, they had zero knowledge of what a virus was or what bacteria was. So whenever you would have an illness that would come, especially something that would reach pandemic proportions, you would need to have a way of explaining what was causing it. So the vampire was what filled that void in science centuries ago.
So with those diseases, does that help us understand some of these superstitions around vampires? Like you can only kill them by driving a stake through its corpse, or if you cover your body in garlic, you'll be able to ward off vampires.
So since you mentioned garlic, that's a good one to utilize, because garlic plays a role in a number of Slavic dishes. Mm. And garlic has always been assumed to be a way to ward off vampires, which is what you actually find in original folklore. And people often wonder, well, why garlic? Well, garlic is known to have a number of properties that assist the human body. For example, it's known to be a blood purifier. Sometimes people take garlic oil supplements for reasons like that. It's a minor antibiotic. Garlic does certain things that are associated with being more healthy. And since the vampire is a symbol of disease, well, then it makes simple sense that the image of that thing would be something that could ward away the vampire. That they would sometimes take the garlic and throw it on the corpses in the grave to essentially keep it in the ground.
And what disease would the vampire garlic myth have been targeting?
For example, we do know with evidence from the 18th century and even after that, that rabies was one of the key diseases that led to certain aspects of the vampire and original belief. Rabies epidemics in Eastern Europe were one of the primary causes of the vampire epidemic in the 18th century, for example. So in rabies, whenever an animal or human being reaches the later stages, like furious rabies, they can be very sensitive to strong smells and things like that. So there's been one theory I've read once that perhaps the strong scent of garlic would have kept people away or animals away that had rabies, for example. So there's one possibility there. There are lots of suggestions, but that's one that would come to mind because of the connection of rabies to the vampire.
So connect the vampire's European roots with its modern expression, say in the Twilight series. What elements remain authentic from the history of vampires that you know and have researched?
Really, the key details in the transmission of the original folklore into modern-day popular culture occurs with that vampire epidemic that I mentioned. The vampire was pretty much completely unknown to Western Europeans until that happens, and what occurred was German and Austrian soldiers who were serving in Serbia to fight against the Ottoman Empire encountered all these vampire beliefs and practices and digging up corpses and garlic and things like that. So they were amazed by this, and when they brought the stories back, there were a lot of academic discussions that occurred about whether or not this is something that's possible. Can the dead come back? Of course, it's not possible. So then after that, the idea, even though it was debunked by scientists and medicine in Western Europe, the idea stuck. So that by the time you get to the 19th century, it starts to become a very big theme in Gothic literature. In particular, it starts in 1819 with a novella by Dr. John Polidori called The Vampire, spelled V-A-M-P-Y-R-E. And that particular novella was very influential. It was very popular. Lord Ruthven was as popular as the name Dracula today for about 30 years or so after publication. Then you get more and more vampires that start to appear throughout that entire era that really sort of continue that element of this creepy aristocratic vampire that typically preys on young women. That was the image that Lord Ruthven was. That's what Dracula is, but Dracula comes almost 90 years later, actually, in this chain of vampires of developing literature. Mm. And so then when you jump to the 20th century, the novel Dracula is eventually translated into theater first in 1924 by Hamilton Dean, and then it finds its way with Bela Lugosi, of course, in the United States in 1927 on Broadway, and then it's in film in 1931 with the legendary Universal Pictures production of Dracula. So when that film came out, Lugosi was a sex symbol, and it really started the transition of the vampire into what it is today, Dracula being the biggest image. But from that point, there are tons of things I could talk about, you know, that lead into the Twilight. So Twilight, you know, does retain a number of features of the vampire in original folklore, but it's just really the most recent phenomenon we've had where there was so much interest in the vampire was that series, you know. But it's not the first time that's happened. It won't be the last.
Stanley Stepanek teaches a course on Dracula at the University of Virginia, speaking with us from Charlottesville. Thank you very much for your time, Stanley. Happy Halloween.
Yeah, you too. Thank you so much.
Keep a lookout for all those little vampires on Sunday night, and don't rule out the necklace of garlic. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online at theworld.org. Have a safe weekend. We'll see you on Monday.